Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Enquiry. My guest tonight is writer, translator, radio and television broadcaster, Jeremy Minot. And we're going to be talking about his new book, Birds in the Ancient World, Winged Words. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
This is an amazing book, and it covers an awful lot of ground, but ultimately, when you get to it, and especially the last chapter, this is a chronicle of how ancient Mediterranean cultures have thought about nature. Is that safe to say?
That's true, and in particular about birds is one of the most prominent, of course, and pervasive aspects of nature.
Now, you've written a lot about humans and their relationship to nature before, but why the focus on ancient Greece and Rome?
Well, I think there was something very special about that culture or series of cultures. Birds were obviously more pervasive and upfront and in your face in the ancient world than they are now. There was an abundance and diversity of birds, which, alas, in Britain today is completely unknown. The situation in America is rather different, but in Britain, we've lost or are nearly losing a huge number of birds who have been central to the cultural history and literary history of these islands. Birds like the nightingale, the turtle dove, the cuckoo, the skylark, the curlew, these are all seriously endangered now, which is quite unbelievable, really, when you think of their prominence in our culture.
When you think about Shakespeare, just Shakespeare alone mentions every one of those birds.
Someone calculated that if you edited out all the references to birds in Shakespeare, there'd be scarcely a page less left undefaced. You're quite right. The first thing that strikes me about the classical world is that the situation is very different. Birds are common there. Birds are abundant. Birds are known by ordinary people. If they weren't known by ordinary people, they wouldn't have appeared in the way they do in both the literature and the art. The references to birds were such that it was assumed that people could just understand and recognize what was being said. I mean, one classical author I talk about quite a bit in the book is Aristophanes, the playwright, who wrote political satires. Well, his works are saturated with birds. He even got one play called The Birds, which is a satire on the political state of Athens at the time. Well, you could search the plays of Tom Stoppard or someone and find never a mention of a bird. And yet, you know, it must have been intelligible to the audience.
Well, you know, this, and again, ultimately what this book to me spoke about is the relationship of comparing our culture to the natural world versus the ancient cultures and their relationship to the natural world. Often we talk about nature as if it's something apart, something different from us. And when you read your references to ancient Greece and Rome, it's part of their everyday life.
That's exactly right, Mark. There were nightingales singing near the center of Greece, near the center of Athens, and near the center of Rome. There would have been vultures and eagles in the sky just outside city limits. You can tell from all the literary references that the city would have been thronging with various kinds of buntings and warblers and finches. There were swallows and swifts nesting around the buildings. There were owls on the Acropolis, which crop up in not only in the literature but as symbols on their coins, for example. Birds were everywhere. They sort of saturated everyday life. And I think that's why they appear both in the popular culture and in the more symbolic levels of artistic representations and indeed in their mythology and folklore.
It's interesting because I've asked contemporary people if they could name 20 bird species that are found around them every single day, and most people can't. Yet when you read this literature from ancient Greece and ancient Rome, it is obvious that people were intimately familiar for a lot of different reasons. I mean, they used birds in their medicine. They used them for food. They used them in augury. They used them as messengers to the gods. I mean, they used birds in every aspect of the culture.
I think that's right. What was the figure you quoted? You asked people to
name 20 birds that are around them every day.
Yeah.
And most people cannot do that. Most people can't name five species of birds that are around them every day.
Well, that's right. And I quote in my book a bit of research that was done in Oxford, actually, where someone interviewed biology students, first-year biology students, and discovered that I think 42% of them were unable to name five British birds. Now, these were biology students. Admittedly, it was Oxford and not Cambridge, and I'm a Cambridge man, but still, you'd think they could have done a bit better than that.
That's, like, shocking. And it's not funny, actually, at the bottom of it. Because, you know, you made the reference to the nightingale. I mean, that throughout literature, from ancient times to through the 1800s, the idea of the nightingale song, sung at night, is a central metaphor, a symbol. And the fact that people can't even relate to that anymore because they're not hearing them, they don't know what it is really sad. And there are cultures the poorer for it.
I do agree with that. It's an impoverished culture when we don't have these references to hand as a matter of lived experience.
Let's talk about auguries, birds as omens and auguries. You mentioned that the Greek word for bird was the same word as for omen?
Yes, indeed. That just shows the significance of birds. The bird is ornis, from which we get ornithology, and that meant both a bird in the sense of the species we call a bird, and also an omen, something that had a larger significance. And indeed, in Latin, augurs gives rise to our word auspicious, which actually means watching birds. So the observation of birds, it was thought as an important form of behavior. And in Homer, where there are many descriptions of this, he also describes specialist bird watchers whose job it was to study the activities of birds as a potential guide to human action, often military action.
That was my next question. So how were birds used to predict a future outcome? Was it odd behavior or certain species that appeared suddenly? I mean, what were they looking for? And obviously it had to be specialists. They had to be these people who are, that's their life, is to watch bird behavior and understand what its significance is.
That's right. Well, the birds most often referred to in Homer, for example, are birds of prey, big raptors, eagles and vultures. And there are many references to the importance of seeing how these birds appeared, where they appeared. And there was a superstition that if they appeared on the right, it was a good sign, and if they appeared on the left, it was a bad sign.
That was reversed by the Romans?
That was exactly so. But, I mean, it strikes me as pretty arbitrary anyway, because it rather depends which way you're facing.
Right. All you have to do is shift your position a little bit, and suddenly it's a good sign.
It makes a little bit more sense when you think that the Greeks were looking north, and therefore if the bird appeared on the right, it was coming from the east, which was thought to be the auspicious side, I suppose, because that's where the sun rose. So there was that kind of semi-belief about it. And how seriously it was taken, it's hard to say. I think it might have been one of those rituals that was performed not quite to predict events, but as a way of doing them properly. I mean, you know, we our lives are full of rituals too. We shake hands, we wave flags, we do all sorts of things that aren't, strictly speaking, rational. But it's a way of, it's a kind of etiquette, but an etiquette performed in this way, in stately fashion.
Now, what about ravens and crows?
Yes, ravens and crows were also thought to be significant birds. Ravens were usually very bad news. And one insight into this comes from a remarkable work which I quote from in the book by a Greek author called Artemidorus, which is, I think, the first ever interpretation of dreams. Indeed, Freud himself acknowledged its importance when he produced his own book called The Interpretation of Dreams. And what Artemidorus did was analyze dreams according to the kind of birds that were dreamt by the dreamer. And obviously this was quite a common thing too. And for example, He said that some of them are very obvious. If you dreamt cormorants, this probably meant danger at sea. Eagles were generally good luck. Vultures were a sign that death might be on the way, because of course they fed on dead creatures.
Right.
Storks were a sign of childbearing to come. Cranes indicated journeys. Ravens, I think, indicated adultery, though I can't quite think why. Starlings indicated disorderly crowds and so on and so forth. Quails indicated hordes of immigrants, a rather vivid image. migratory birds.
But what's amazing, all the things that you're talking about that they're significant of is actually based on the actual behavior of the birds.
Exactly so. And swallows, one I like is, if you saw a swallow, it indicated that there was work to do on your home, because they were birds that nested in houses.
That's right.
So they were a sort of DIY message.
For people who are not European who are listening to the show, people who don't realize that European quails are migratory, and they're a famous migratory bird, unlike the gallinaceous birds here, which are sedentary. They are a famous migrant, and therefore the idea that it would refer to migrants is really amazing.
Yes, well, of course, they migrate in huge hordes, and in fact, that's mentioned in the Bible as well as in Greek literature. I can't quite quote you the chapter and verse now, but there are vast migrations of quails which fall like manna on the... it must have been on the Israelites when they were migrating, I think, themselves.
One of the birds I was surprised about, because you just don't... I have not read that much about it, is woodpeckers as a sign. And you talk about... Pliny talked about... referred to it as the bird of Mars. Why?
Yes, I don't know. Woodpeckers certainly were important for the Romans, and I include one or two illustrations that indicate that in the book, but I honestly don't know why woodpeckers, apart from the fact that they were common, of course, in the woodlands that then existed, and, of course, the black woodpecker is a very charismatic bird. A dominant bird, which makes an extraordinary drumming noise, which I suppose might be taken to have some ritual significance, but beyond that, I can't say.
Now, the Romans, when they came to birds and omens, as was a lot of things that the Romans did, they systematized everything, and they used domestic chickens a lot in their augury. How did they use them?
Yes, they did. The reason they chose chickens, I suspect, was a slightly cynical one, that they were available and dispensable, because a lot of chickens got killed in Roman augury. And the way they used them was a way that sounds extremely curious. There were specialist chicken carers, and they fed the chickens. You know, they threw grain for them. And depending on how actively the chickens fed, this indicated whether it was a good sign or a bad sign. And this was a ritual that was performed before people were going into battle, so quite a lot hung on it. And there are some famous cases in Roman history, which I quote in the book, where either the chickens proved right or the chickens were proved wrong, with fairly disastrous consequences.
See, that's the job I want. I want to be the ornithomancer that reads chicken scratchings. That would be a great job for me.
Yes, you would think, wouldn't you, that a wily chicken carer could probably manipulate their behavior to suit the need of the journey.
I'm sure that went on. Let's spend a brief moment on birds and use in magic and metamorphosis. And I want to dwell on metamorphosis a bit, because that loomed large, especially in Greek and Roman mythology. What did they think about metamorphosis? Did they believe that those stories, and I'm thinking about Ovid's book, which I love. It's one of my favorite pieces of ancient literature. Did they believe that could actually happen, that a human could transform into something else?
No, I don't think they believed it. I think they were wonderful fables with, you know, heavily symbolic elements to them. They're not Ovid's Metamorphoses is a wonderful book, but, you know, predecessors are things like Aesop's fables.
Yep.
Where, you know, birds, I think there are something like 30 different species of birds in Aesop's fables that take principal roles. And they can be humanized, of course. You know, it's a very anthropomorphic exercise, that kind of that kind of literature. And I think that's what's going on, basically, in Ovid. Wonderful stories involving birds, which are taking the part of humans to some extent.
And Ovid's stories, like, were important to painters much later on. For painters from the Renaissance all the way through the Romantic period really took Ovid's stories and painted examples of them. There and poets wrote about them, and it's a central piece of literature that is important to Western culture.
That's absolutely right. Ovid was a hugely influential Latin author, both in art and in literature, more so later than in his own time, I think. But that could be said of various other classical authors, and it's a rather healthy warning that one shouldn't always judge people by their contemporary reputations. Put it tactfully.
But some of the stories in Ovid about metamorphosis and birds, one of my favorites is about the fall of Phaethon and how Cygnus became a swan. And that's, first of all, we still remember that because when we use the Latin word for swans, it's a cygnus, a baby swan is a cygnet. But that's these are great stories even today.
They're all great stories, but they are stories.
Okay. Now, in magic, you wrote about something that just I had never heard of before and really blew my mind. The use of a wry neck as an erotic aid.
Gosh, yes. yes, wry neck. The Greek word for wry neck was eunx, from which we get the English word jinx. And to put a wry neck on someone was to put a jinx on them. That's where that expression comes from. And this is very bad news for wry necks, but which were captured and impaled on a kind of wheel, which was then spun as a way of putting a spell on the beloved, either to attract them or to repel them. Since there were probably more disappointed lovers around than there were wry necks, I can imagine this was a conservation problem. But yes, it's a weird story, isn't it? There are images as well as some poetic descriptions of this process. So it undoubtedly was something.
There's a series. You mentioned a series of bird dances, and as actually you reproduce an Attic Black figure of bird dancers. Do we know what's going on in those black figure paintings? Because they're really interesting. The bird dancer image that you put in the book is wild. It's not like anything I've ever seen before.
They are extraordinary, aren't they?
Yeah.
There have been various hypotheses by scholars about this. One attractive one, though it can't be sustained, I don't think, was that these were actually illustrations of contemporary Greek comedies. For example, one of them was claimed to be an illustration of Aristophanes' Birds, because in Greek comedies you nearly always had a chorus, and the chorus would be dressed up appropriately, and of course the birds would have been dressed with feathers and plumes and made out like birds. And so these bird dancers could have been dancers or chorus members of a Greek comedy, or indeed a Greek tragedy. And quite a lot of other comedies were named after wildlife. There's one, there were the wasps, for example. There are the ants. There are cranes. So using some species as the central character in your comedy was not an unusual thing at all. Again, another emphasis on just how important
right
wildlife and birds were in the ancient world.
You talk about crane dances, owl dances, and one of my favorites, and it really piqued my interest, was the wagtail dance that you said sounds like the hokey pokey.
That's right. You put them in and then you take them out.
When you included the translation of that section, and it really did sound like that.
It did sound like that, didn't it? Yeah, that's right. The wagtail dance. And I'm glad you picked that up. It was one of my favorites, and my suggestion that it was rather like the hokey cokey was flippant, of course, but there are similarities.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, translator, radio and television broadcaster Jeremy Minot. And we're talking about his new book. It is an amazing volume, Birds in the Ancient World, Winged Words. It's amazing, and you include a lot of these. How many phrases were used that have to do with birds that originated in either ancient Greece or ancient Rome? Ancient proverbs, things like one swallow doesn't make a spring, a true friend is a rare bird. The list is almost endless. It is incredible how much we owe our bird metaphors to the ancients.
You're right. There are a lot of them which are very familiar. You've quoted one or two. One swallow doesn't make a spring. Birds of a feather flock together.
Right.
There are some that need a bit of translating. They had one called Owls to Athens, which is the equivalent of the British proverb Coals to Newcastle, meaning unnecessary imports, as it were. And the point of the Greek one was that owls in this context were the coins, which were called owls because they had the picture of the little owl on them.
And the little owl was sacred to Athena.
That's exactly right, and that's how it got onto the coin, because Athena was the patron goddess of Athens, and the owl was one of her special. The owl and the olive tree were two of her special devotional objects. The little owl appeared on an Athenian coinage, and they got known as owls. And so owls to Athens means there's no point in taking those coins to Athens. One jackdaw is always found near another. That's birds of a feather, for example.
Right.
There are some that need a bit more imagination to understand. For example, an eagle doesn't catch flies. That's one of my favorites, meaning don't bother with trifles. Every lark must have his crest. Huh. Things are unavoidable. Further than a kite roams, that is a huge distance.
Wow.
So there's a whole string of proverbs, again, relating to the natural world. And we have these still, but the British proverbs, the proverbs in the English language, which are shared between Britain and America, were, of course, formed a long while ago when, to some extent, the ubiquity of birds that I'm describing in the classical world also obtained in our worlds. So they're ancient proverbs that rang true. And like our literature, they may come to seem very strange in future. If you never see a swallow in summer,
that's right.
That proverb will make no sense. And swallows are getting rarer.
One of the things that was fascinating that they came to at the end of the book is you talk about the absence of butterflies. And that is fascinating. We don't really know what the answer is.
Well, I don't know what the answer is. Some answers have been claimed. I observed that most peculiarly, no one mentions butterflies by name until Aristotle. And so we're talking about the middle of the 4th century by then, say 350 BC or something. And yet, by then, you've had 300 years of literature, starting with Homer. And you would think butterflies were just ideal for some of the similes and metaphors that you would expect in Homer, or symbols of fragility or shortness of life. You'd expect to find it in the lyric poets or in some travel writings that exist. But no one mentions butterflies, and the absence is a real little mystery. One of the solutions proffered, which I don't actually agree with, is that it depends on a linguistic fact that the word for butterfly, psyche, is the same as the word for soul, from which, we get words like psychology. And it was thought that maybe there was a superstition about naming butterflies because they shared this word, psyche, with the soul. That doesn't seem to me to hold water at all. The Greeks had very few inhibitions about mentioning anything. I mean, the ancient comedies are just full of ribaldry, of impiety of various kinds. You know, there were no holds barred. And there are plenty of pictures of butterflies which suggest that that can't be the case. So it's a genuine mystery, and I don't understand it. But it's worth pointing out. they're referred to in Latin literature more freely. The word then was papilio, a butterfly, and these crop up in Ovid and other places, but there's just nothing in Greek literature, and this just puzzles me.
It is weird. It's a very strange thing, but you're right. I mean, the Greeks wrote about everything, and including other invertebrates. And so it's not that it's a lesser animal that they wouldn't pay attention to. And you have to believe the butterflies were everywhere then.
You do. I mean, again, some people say, well, perhaps they didn't have any butterflies.
Oh, no.
That would have been true.
That can't be true.
They had more than we did.
That's right. That's right.
They had not polluted their land in the way that we have done. Butterflies would have been abundant. They're colorful. They were just such natural things for people to comment on that I really don't understand it.
It's weird. Well, we're almost out of time.
As you make an important point also, Mark, that other invertebrates, I mean, ants,
right,
cicadas, bees,
I know,
wasps,
it's all mentioned.
They're all mentioned both in a descriptive way and in a poetic way. You know, ants and bees are admired as social creatures that are capable of acts of community coordination and so on, which, again, is good observation. Wasps were thought to be dangerous things and so on and so forth, but just not butterflies.
It's you know, until I read your writing about this, it never even occurred to me. But once that I've read that section of the book, it's one of those things that really nags at me because it really needs a better explanation. What people have offered just doesn't seem to be satisfying. Before we have 1 minute left, I just want to talk about how the playwright Aeschylus died. I want you to, because that's one of my great stories. I love that.
Well, poor old Aeschylus, yes. It was thought that a lamergeier, which is a kind of vulture, which hunts by feeding on one of his favorite preys is a tortoise, and it was thought that a lamergeier was flying with a tortoise in its talons, about to drop it on a rock so the rock would break open and he could get at the tortoise. And instead it hit the poor bald head of Aeschylus and brought an untimely end to one of the great poets.
Do you think that – I want to believe that that actually happened, but it's probably apocryphal. But still, it's a great story.
Well, let's both believe it, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You've been listening to WICN 90.5 FM. I've been talking to Jerry Minot. He's a writer, translator, radio and television broadcaster, and we've been talking about his new book. It is beautifully done. Birds in the Ancient World, Winged Words. Jeremy, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.